Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. All right, we are in paper 53, section 2, which is old single column page 602. Okay, so recall from last session, you know, we started this this new block of papers, just pair of papers on the Lucifer Rebellion. We got that initial little, kind of setting the stage, giving us the cast of characters, as it were, in that first section. And you can see the lead, it's entitled The Leaders of the Rebellion, so they were literally kind of giving you the cast of characters. Now remember that these two papers are most immediately focused on the rebellion, actually on the local system headquarters worlds, as opposed to the planetary rebellions on the 37 worlds that joined the system rebellion, like for instance ours. But, remember they did, in that previous section, they were talking a little bit about the cast of characters on our world. But, now we're kind of, back to the system headquarters, and they want to really focus in on what happened, roughly 200,000 years ago there on Gerasim. And, this next section here is, as you can see from the title, is what immediately led up to the public presentation of the rebellion. As you can see in section 3 is the Lucifer Manifesto. So let's just jump right in, and you'll see this first little paragraph will give us some context we'll talk about for a little bit here.
Section 2, the causes of rebellion. Lucifer and his first assistant, Satan, had reigned on Jerusalem for more than 500,000 years when, in their hearts, they began to array themselves against the Universal Father and his then vicegerent son, Michael.
Okay, see, so that's just that simple little statement. You're going, what's the point? Why set that, just that little seemingly factual, straightforward statement off in a separate paragraph? They obviously want you to go between the lines, what's beyond the immediacy. That statement of the two of them, the system sovereign and his assistant, had been reigning on Gerasim for more than 500,000 years. Now, that's on Gerasim, so we're talking, Gerasim time, local system time. Which, remember, is not that far removed, when all is said and done. In terms of the year is not that, that radically different from our year, but it's a little less. You're talking like about 81%, of our year. So you're talking, roughly 405,000 of our years. It's like, well, okay, that's 400,000, 500,000, what's the big difference? Obviously, again, that's not the point. They're wanting you to combine this with something else. What's the point they're trying to make? Now, way back, you don't have to turn. I'm just going to remind you of a little statement that was made. Way back, remember when we were reading about the Lenonidex sons? That's what? Paper 35, section 9. They told us this little detail about system sovereigns. They said the system sovereigns rule in commissions of two or three on the headquarters of each system of inhabited worlds. The Constellation Father names one of these Lenonidex as chief every decamillennium. Sometimes no change in the head of the trio is made, the matter being entirely optional with the constellation rulers. System governments do not suddenly change in personnel unless a tragedy of some sort occurs. Okay. All right, so they're wanting you to remember that little statement. So now there we're talking about, And they say that the system sovereign has a, you know, a stint of a decamillennium. See, you know, that's the constellation Father is behind that, right? So we're talking local universe time there. And if you remember local universe time, the year ends up being, their year ends up being about 5 of our years. You know, so a decamillennium is about 50,000 of our years. Okay, and you notice it was 2 or 3. Well, in our case, we have 2. You know, we had 2 rather than 3. Okay, and then also, right before, in the last section there, up in paper 53, remember when they were telling us about the cast of characters, they were talking about the first lieutenant, Satan, and they mentioned but he had never functioned as a system sovereign, they said. Okay, so if you put all that together, they want you to appreciate that, you know, they'd been there for many of these 50,000 of our year cycles, right? The constellation Father had reinstated Lucifer, you know, over and over and over. Right? I mean, you know, they must have been in their 9th stint, right? When they rebelled. You see, so that's an important thing to bring into play, that little bit of, you know, factual data about that. You know, that Lucifer had been assessed many, many times. You know, and not only was he, you know, reinstated, but, you know, it wasn't even cycled with, you know, with Satan. Right? It was cycled with Satan. You know, the constellation Father, you know, didn't, you know, like bounce back and forth between the two or something like that over that long span of time. You know, so in other words, you know, everything seemed to be very well, you know, with this circumstance. With a multiplicity of assessment over and over and over, this had been assessed by the authorities above the local system, and everything deemed to be, you know, running just fine. Just keep on what you're doing, you know, the constellation Father said. Right. So just wanted to, you know, to bring that in. See, they're giving you that as just a simple little factual recognition of how this was this didn't build over a long span of time. You know, it built up over a relatively short span of time. Why would something this cataclysmic for our local system, you know, build up over such a short period of time, you might ask? You know, remember, you're fundamentally talking about a spiritual consciousness gone astray. And spiritual consciousness can function very geometrically, right, as opposed to simply arithmetically. And so it doesn't have to take a very long time for someone to go from, you know, pretty centered and solid with things to way, way off in left field. And that's what happened. In a relatively short span of time, things went very, very off the rails. Okay, so that's what they want to get at. And then the other just little tiny thing to note in there, I think this may have come up last time, you know, when in their hearts, you notice that statement, you know, here back in, you know, our little sentence, or our little paragraph here, when in their hearts they began to array themselves. You know, again, you can use the hourglass analogy, right, for their mindful selves just like ours. Right? And they have an upper domain. They have a temple within. They have a heart. Right? The revelators are, whenever they use the word heart, they're not referring to some, you know, levels of feeling, you know, delusion or something like that. They literally mean the upper domain and the hourglass analogy, you know, the temple within, the heart, the personalized domain of that individual's mind. You know, that's the only place that things can really go bad, you know, because that's the domain that the personality is directly engaged to. All right, so And so that, you know, that leverages into something that, you know, again, we want to stress up front as we read forward. Remember that the whole point of reading this is not to get a little synopsis of some ancient historical event, you know, just for our historical edification, right? It's to understand how, just like Lucifer, you could go down this path, right? That if you actually begin to engage your spiritual consciousness to any degree, you need to be finding a bridle. You need to put that bridle on. You need to figure out how to work the reins. Because if you don't, if you just think, oh no, I don't want to use a bridle. I just want to hop on bareback and let the horse run free. Okay, things can go astray very quickly and very extremely. Right? Your spiritual consciousness is not innately divine, and it's much more animated, much more energetic than your material consciousness. And so, we want to understand what we need to keep in mind, well, keep focused on, and we can. As we go through the pathology of this, you can recognize, wow, that sounds very familiar. That sounds like a whole bunch of things that I'm seeing going on in the world around me. Right? That's why this book is in my lap. Right? There's this emergency that's ensued because there's an awful lot of people that think that their spiritual consciousness doesn't need a bridle. Right? All right, and so unwittingly, they will follow the exact same, you know, path that Lucifer did. I mean, there's a physics, right, of the energies, you know, of the energies involved, and you can't do anything but just repeat the exact same sequence of thoughts.
And do you see that in the Urantia community? I mean, should I worry about why all my friends have left?
It's you know much easier to appreciate the severity of the problem if you go, you know, to the world at large, right? I mean, this book isn't here because a handful of people on the planet, you know, are confused.
But it's a personal lesson too, right? In terms of what our revelation and what it means to us, and how we have to really rein it in.
Right. And certainly yes, and you know, and the other, I was just going to say that the other thing is, you know, remember, you're not put on this planet to fix other people. Right? You know the comment about things would go a lot better if you stopped making personal plans for other individuals, right? That's not your job here, you know, is to fix the planet or fix other people, fix your family members, you know, whatever. Right, your job is self-mastery. Not other mastery, self-mastery. Right? That's your job, really. And it's really your only job. And the extent to which you are successful that to any degree, there might be another job open for you. Okay? But not so much if there's not much self-mastery there. Right? So, you know, this is, you know, you'll see that as we get into this, that's the whole thing that went astray. The belief that a self doesn't need to be mastered. That a self is innately divine, and you can just let it run without a bridle.
So, Chris. Yep. So, while he's on Jiris and he's thinking of this, you know, going about the universal father, why in the hell would he come here? Why would they let him come here? I don't understand why they. Because they, you know, that they know that he's thinking these things. Why would they let him come?
Well, we'll get to that.
I know it's further down.
Yeah. But it's just, you know, remember, fundamentally, it's an evolutionary domain. You know, it's an evolutionary domain. And the whole point is you're going to be exposed to a test.
So they want us to go to the very...
Everyone has to pass a test.
Very least.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, we'll see that, you know, very definitively as we get forward here, that, you know, it's very, you know, that's the big challenge. You know, we're not... No one on the planet has ever thought about God like the revelation, you know, is explaining God. Remember, the fundamental thing in this book is not the ideal of God. Right? Humans have gotten that a long time ago. it's their idea of God that's always had a big issue, right? Like an idea that, well, God would never allow such and so to happen, right? That's a very problematic idea of God that the revelators are trying to correct in us. You have to separate an existential domain like Havona, where, yes, God would never allow from where you live, right? We don't live in the central universe. We live in a domain where nothing is automatic up front. Everything has to be chosen with the inevitabilities in play, with the contrast in front of you. If you want something, I mean, great things happened in Havona. The point is not to have similarly great things happen out here. The point is to have greater things happen out here than can ever occur in Havona, right? And see, the thing that makes it greater is that contrast. There is no contrast. The choices in Havona are not made with the opposite as a potential. And so the greatness is limited. But out here, everything is chosen with the contrast in play. And so we can go above and beyond anything that an existential domain like Havona can ever achieve. Yeah, that's the inevitabilities. Yeah, that's why it's so far up in the front of the book, to try to get you to appreciate that. If you're going to do great things, then must you have the potential for the opposite, right there, immediately accessible to you. And so you're going to choose to not do that self-oriented thing. You're gonna go beyond any of the selves in Havona. Okay. All right. So let's get in. See a little bit further here.
There were no peculiar or special conditions in the system of Satania which suggested or favored rebellion. It is our belief that the idea took origin and form in Lucifer's mind, and that he might have instigated such a rebellion no matter where he might have been stationed. Lucifer first announced his plans to Satan, but it required several months to corrupt the mind of his able and brilliant associate. However, when once converted to the rebel theories, he became a bold and earnest advocate of, quote, self-assertion and liberty.
Okay, two things before we get to the meat. Just noticed a little kind of passing thing. We were just talking about the whole time stuff, like Gerasim has a day because it rotates on its axis, just like the Earth does, and hence has a day. And remember how it works, that they take the day, whatever it is, the Salvington day or the Gerasim day, and they multiply it by 10 to get a quote-unquote week. They multiply it by 100 to get a quote-unquote year. And, we've never talked about it. It's like, well, what about, we have that an in-between chunk of time. We have a month. Well, think about it. What's the month based upon? How long it takes the moon to go around the Earth, right? Notice there, it required several months. They tossed that in. You're going, well, how long is a month on Gerasim? Remember, there's the satellites and sub-satellites. There's that whole string of pearls of seven satellites, seven moons going around Gerasim. So there is some month. We don't know how long it is. The fact that they're, the way they say it here, it must be just like our month. It's more than a week and less than a year. But where it is, I don't quite know. But it's just, just remember that you've got those moons going around. And so they have a time scale there, Well, moons go around one time, that's a month. So just notice that little bit in passing there. But the quote-unquote self-assertion and liberty. Right? So this is the big deal, right? As I was saying up front, this aggrandizement of self, this putting of the self at the center. And, they've got it quote-unquote like that, not just because, that's what they're always talking about, is self-assertion and liberty. But there's their confusion about those things, right? What they meant when they said self-assertion, what they meant when they said liberty, and therein lies the big, part of the big problem. Like I've tried to stress a lot recently, you have free will, but that's not self-assertion. And in general, humans, every time in all of history that they've used the expression free will, what they've actually been talking about is self-assertion. Because they really can't, they had no philosophic context to genuinely talk about free will. Because at best, humans have imagined that they have a mind and a body. That there were two facts. And so the most they could think of is mind over matter. My mind saying, I want this cup to be lifted off that table. And humans have tended to say, that's because I have free will. I exercised free will and lifted up that cup. No, that's not free will. It's absolutely nothing to do with free will. All right? Mind over matter, you have a mindful self. That mind can assert itself over matter. Self-assertion is that outer life over control potential that you have. Asserting your mindful self upon things and beings in the external world. Free will, once you recognize that you aren't just a dual phenomenon of mind and body, but there's another element in play. Right? There's three energies, matter, mind, and spirit. Right? And you have a personality that's immediately engaged to that spiritual nature above mind. And spirit dominates mind. Free will is purely an inner life thing. It has nothing to do with the outer life. It's purely an inner life fact. And it's your liberty to say, well, the laws of mind energy would normally dictate this following sequence of forms in my mind. But I have a potential over control over that. I'm not a helpless victim of that causal sequence. I can say, no, mind, you are not going to respond to that stimulus like that. It's going to be the opposite. Right, courage is required here, and that's not natural. I'm going to artfully construct that in my mind as a free will exercise. That's free will. That's where you have liberty, is in the inner life. Right? You basically are sovereign in the inner life, free will. Right? Liberty is a spiritual word, fundamentally. If you want to talk about transferring things out to the outer life, you ought to use the word freedom. Right? And your freedoms can be taken away from you. I can be locked up, and then I'm not free to roam about. But no one can take my true liberty away. I have sovereignty in the inner life. I have free will. It's free from any potential, including the universal Father. Can't touch it. No one can touch it. It has an absolute dimension. It has the potential to overcome an infinite influence if necessary. It is free.
So liberty doesn't need an advocate. it's already self. It's existent.
Right. See, you see where they were going, right? They were going where humans almost all the time go, that liberty is something about the arrangement of molecules in the external world, right? And the moment you start going down that path, everything is going to get all messed up. that burning passion is meant for the inner life, and as soon as you try to somehow realize it in the outer life, it's going to have to be at the expense of others. Right? in order for your free will to go from the inner life to the outer life, in this imaginary, you know, extension, right, everyone is have to become a slave to you, you know, or your will, supposedly, or quote-unquote will, is not free. You know, so I say it's quote-unquote right here. Okay, so, you know, this notion that I should, that my liberty should be directly expressible as self-assertion. No. No, your self-assertion is always going to be limited. When you get to Havona, you have the economy of Havona. You have the laws of the house. When you get to the Isle of Paradise, there's absolute law, right, in the outer life. Right? You know, and you're not free to assert yourself any old way you want. Right? But in the inner life, right, you have liberty still. That's the fundamental problem. And that's what gets always gets the problem started when you don't recognize this, and that there's this difference between the outer life and the inner life. See, and it's not until the fifth epical revelation they've tried to get us to recognize we have a threefold nature instead of a twofold at best. Now, what do you do with even self-assertion if you take the monistic view that like everything is just matter and there isn't even mind? You know, that's why a lot of current thinkers really wrestle with, you know, what to do with quote-unquote free will. What they really mean is what to do with self-assertion. If we don't even have minds, if all there is brain, right? I mean,
they can't even explain consciousness. Right, in a monistic world, there's no consciousness.
Right. You know, it all gets very, absurd. You know, but to avoid, see, the fundamental way to avoid, you know, going down the wrong path is to remind yourself, no, free will, liberty, is an inner life thing only. And the moment that I start making plans for others, you know, as an expression of my quote-unquote free will, you're going down the Lucifer path.
Question?
Yep.
Self-searching liberty sound like a perfect theme for the 4th of July. I mean, isn't this the whole theme of the United States?
Yes, and we definitely get into this, right? I mean, we know that liberty burns with a passion, and to begin to recognize how the founding fathers had an awareness of true liberty in contrast to false liberty, but how many others on the planet have not properly distinguished, and how the United States has begun to forget its founding distinction from those others, and began to buy into the false liberty notions of the rest of the world. Right? Yes, with the 4th of July coming up, it is very appropriate that we rediscover the distinction between true and false liberty. Right? We are the nation set forth to make that distinction to the whole world. Right? And we're dropping the ball. And if we do, then the whole world goes into another interregnum. That's, you know, what the revelators tell us. That's the challenge. You know, if we adopt false liberty like everyone else has always had the tendency to, then there's going to be another Dark Ages. Just like Lincoln said long ago at the end of the Gettysburg Address, right? If the light goes out, right, it's going to be dark. Okay? That's just the way it is. Yes. Okay, so you're taking this very powerful spiritual word, liberty, and you're misapplying it. And everything goes very bad when you do that. Okay?
No one ever suggested rebellion to Lucifer. The idea of self-assertion in opposition to the will of Michael and to the plans of the Universal Father, as they are represented in Michael, had its origin in his own mind. His relations with the Creator Son had been intimate and always cordial. At no time prior to the exaltation of his own mind did Lucifer openly express dissatisfaction about the universe administration. Notwithstanding his silence, for more than 100 years of standard time, the union of days on Salvington had been reflectivating to Uversa that all was not at peace in Lucifer's mind. This information was also communicated to the Creator Sun and the Constellation Fathers of Norlaishadek.
Okay, so now the plot thickens. See, they didn't waste much time getting to the point here. But you see, like I was saying up front, relatively, this all went astray in a very short time. Now, it's 100 years of standard time. There they actually put it so that there wasn't a confusion where you might think it was Gerasim time. So we're talking 500 years, right? So just over the span of 500 years, relative to that, a little over 400,000 years, things start going astray, and it's also reminding you, like we talked so much when we were reading, previous papers. You remember, your mind is an open book. The entire universe can read your mind, and are, from very remote distances even, right? Now, don't worry. I mean, it's just like worrying about, whether or not your phone is tapped, by the NSA or something. I mean, the universe has got a lot of better things to do than to listen to your animal origin thoughts. I mean, no one in the universe cares about your animal origin thoughts.
The NSA does.
and they also don't care about, me, my animal origin doings. But, but still, everything real about your mind is known. See, and that's what we're talking about here. I mean, and reality, is a binary thing in this regard. Either you're positively attuned to reality or negatively attuned to reality. He had been positively attuned to reality for a long, long time, and everyone was recording that, and then individuals who were observing noticed, wait a minute, okay? He's not actually going astray. He's really going astray here, right? You have a personalized mindal self that's beginning to misapply that free will. There is a peace that's being disrupted. You notice how they said that. All is not at peace in Lucifer's mind, right? Your conformity to the cosmos is inherently a peace, right? It's the universal harmony, right? And if you begin to flip yourself, in a negative relationship to that, it's the opposite of the universal harmony. All is not at peace, okay? And, so you notice it was, you have this fundamental assessment with the ancients of days on high and the unions of days and the faithfuls of days, extending down, that are immediately keeping track of this. But, the union of days is definitely going to be informing the Creator Son. And the Constellation Fathers, are kind of like the deputies for the ancients of days, right? So like they're mentioning, all those that need to know. But again, 500 years of our time, and no one is stepping in, right? Because this is an evolutionary domain. This is part of the process. Especially if it's a part of the evolutionary domain like we're in, where you're even more so letting things just play out. Remember, some local universes are run as tighter ships than others, right? Our Creator Son, lets things be quite loose. So definitely in our local universe, no one is going to immediately jump in, pull Lucifer out of his job. They're going to let it play out. I'm sure everyone likes the idea of mercy. But, this is the flip side of it. It's like, well, if you really love mercy, remember, that means, right? The more mercy there is, the more rebellions you can potentially have. Right? If all there was absolute justice, there wouldn't ever be a rebellion. Right? Not 500 years, 10 seconds after Lucifer started going astray, boom. Remember, that was that little vignette of that while Michael was on his seventh bestowal here, You know, the Union of Days is in charge, and you know, and he's sort of directly representing the Ancients of Days, the capital J judges. And he reminded Michael, you know, okay, while you're, you know, out of commission, basically, especially when you're a babe in Bethlehem, you know, you're out of commission definitely for a while. You know, I'm going to run the ship, you know, like the capital J judges directly, right? I mean, so, you know, a system sovereign is not even going to get 10 seconds. He's going to get a half a second, and he's going to be exterminated. Right? You know, zero mercy, you know, in that sense. Right? All right, so anyway, that's what we've got. We've got things are starting to build, but over a relatively short period of time. And you see it's, as they started out that paragraph, the idea of self-assertion, right? All about you and your desires, your perspectives, your opinions being put first. Right? Okay.
Throughout this period, Lucifer became increasingly critical of the entire plan of universe administration, but always professed wholehearted loyalty to the supreme rulers. His first outspoken disloyalty was manifested on the occasion of a visit of Gabriel to Jerusalem, just a few days before the open proclamation of the Lucifer Declaration of Liberty. Gabriel was so profoundly impressed with the certainty of the impending outbreak that he went direct to Audiencia to confer with the Constellation Fathers regarding the measures to be employed in case of open rebellion.
Okay. You know, it's all pretty straightforward, but just a couple little things to note. Notice how it's wholehearted loyalty to the supreme rulers. I mean, fundamentally what you've got, when all is said and done here, the contrast, the two sides, you know, as we'll see in a little bit, there's the quote-unquote God of Liberty on the one side, you know, Lucifer, and it's God the sevenfold on the other side. Fundamentally, the contrast here is not what we would think. You know, we, because of our monotheistic, you know, heritage, you know, we tend to think in very simplistic terms. You know, we immediately jump to what, you know, what we call the Universal Father. But it's not that. It's the hierarchy of deity that is, you know, identified with creatures. You know, it's God the sevenfold. You know, and most specifically, the three lower rungs of that hierarchy, the supreme creators and controllers, the supreme rulers, right? You know, so, and you know, and everyone knows that, you know, not you know, even the master spirits are a little bit kind of out of sight here. It's most poignantly in play is the lowest rung with the Creator Son and the Creative Mother Spirit, and the Ancients of Days, you know, and the next rung up. You know, and remember what they said in that first paragraph, Vicegerent Son. Remember, this is pre-seventh bestowal. So, you know, it's you don't literally have the supreme rulership in Michael yet, right? He doesn't have supreme deity in him yet. You know, so, you know, that's another reason why the by nature supreme rulers of the Ancients of Days play such a point person role like they do as the capital J judges. Right? The Master Spirits are on the Isle of Paradise. Creator Sons don't start out as Master Sons. Right? So someone, right from the get-go, has got to be out here in the trenches and be fully in supreme mode. Right? So that's why the Ancients of Days are the capital J judges. Okay, so there's that. And then notice that it's just a few days, okay, before the proclamation of the rebellion, that he's saying things to Gabriel. So think about that. I mean, if he was at the point, as they're going to talk about here next, if he was at the point where he'd come to recognize, oh, wait a minute, this isn't good, this is actually bad, he wouldn't be openly talking to Gabriel. So before the proclamation of the manifesto, he's obviously still in the mode where he thinks bad is good. you know, and he's willing to share in this great idea he's got. Okay? Right. Yeah, so as you see, we're going to talk about that next. You know, going from evil to sin happens sometime after he goes public.
Yeah.
Right? At this point, it's just error and evil. It's not yet sin.
Mm-hmm. Do you think Gabriel was like, okay, well, that was a nice chat. I'll see you later. Or do you think that he actually got into a bait and said, that's not correct.
No. Again, see, I mean, you know that simply because Gabriel doesn't even do that once, you know, it's fully open and, you know, in play.
Right, yeah.
Everyone goes, Gabriel, why aren't you standing forth? Like, oh, that'll come. Right. No, he would have just, smiled pleasantly, nodded his head, hightailed it too, didn't you?
I'll be gone for a little while.
The fact that he's got this loyalty to the supreme rulers, which you said to be the Ancients of Days.
Well, the whole hierarchy, the Master Spirits, the Ancients of Days, the Creator Son, Creator Mother Spirit. Yeah.
So because it was only error at this point, why the Ancients of Days didn't step up.
Error and evil. It's only error and evil at this point.
So it hadn't turned to evil yet, had it?
No, it's evil, but not yet sin. It's not deliberate yet.
So if it's error and evil, and then the Ancients of Days are right there, but they're going to let him go forward with it before annihilating him?
Yeah, I mean, you don't get annihilated. You don't get annihilated because of error, evil, or even sin. You're only annihilated if you get all the way to iniquity.
Yeah, iniquity. So he hadn't been there yet.
Yeah, and he's not even remotely there, yeah. Okay. He hasn't even sinned once yet.
He thinks Gabriel's all into it with him.
Yeah. I mean, again, think about that. You know, he's standing there, you know, putting out the manifesto. That's not technically a sin yet. He hasn't deliberately chosen that which he knows to be bad. He thinks what he's doing is good. It's like altruistic. It's for the greater good. I mean, he has all the positive things that you've ever yearned for in mind as he's doing this. There's not one shred of willful negativity in his mind, right? He wants light and life desperately, just like you do. Too desperately, see? Too impatiently, right? That's the problem.
This sounds really familiar to today.
Yeah.
Right. You said it would.
Right.
Patience, anyone?
Yes. Oh, you got something on the web?
Okay. A real quick question from Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
She's wondering if you think that Lucifer knew his thoughts were being read.
Yeah, everyone knows. Yeah.
At that level.
Right, and again, not only do they know, they know the physics of all this stuff.
Sure.
Right, for us, this is all very abstract, No, they can stub their toe on spirit substance, yeah. Right? And all the physics, and great complexity about matter, mind, and spirit energy. Right, this is all very, very... And we'll get to that in a little bit. You got to remember, the things that they take for granted, if we experienced, we would immediately, prostrate ourselves in worship, thinking, this is run-of-the-mill day-to-day stuff for them, mm-hmm. Right? Totally prosaic for them. It's, transcendently sublime poetry for us, right? But it's just a shoulder shrug for them. And we'll get to that when we get to the manifesto.
It is very difficult to point out the exact cause or causes which finally culminated in the Lucifer Rebellion. We are certain of only one thing, and that is, whatever these first beginnings were, they had their origin in Lucifer's mind. There must have been a pride of self that nourished itself to the point of self-deception, so that Lucifer, for a time, really persuaded himself that his contemplation of rebellion was actually for the good of the system, if not the universe. By the time his plans had developed to the point of disillusionment, no doubt he had gone too far for his original and mischief-making pride to permit him to stop. At some point in this experience, he became insincere and evil, evolved into deliberate and willful sin. That this happened is proved by the subsequent conduct of this brilliant executive. He was long offered opportunity for repentance, but only some of his subordinates ever accepted the proffered mercy. The faithful of Days of Adentia, on the request of the Constellation Fathers, in person presented the plan of Michael for the saving of these flagrant rebels. But always was the mercy of the Creator's Son rejected, and rejected with increasing contempt and disdain.
Okay, so that's the little vignette of the sad story. Okay, so you see it right there. They're talking about making that transition from evil to sin. Right? At some point he became insincere. The disillusionment is, right? He in his mind, he's looking at this, you know, his thoughts, and he's seeing good, 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 good. It's light, 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 light. And then it's de-lit. Right? He's encircled in the Holy Spirit. He has the three cosmic intuitions, right? Eventually they kick in and he sees through, right, this apparent goodness to its reality. He goes, oh, no, it's not good, it's bad. But he'd already gone public,
yeah,
right? Right. That comment. See, that's why I was stressing that. You know, trying to figure out. It's like, well, you know, what's this whole bit about? He couldn't sort of turn around. Right? I mean, see, you know, the biggie is he's gone public. He's a system sovereign. Everyone looks up to him. Talk about losing face, right? Right.
Oops.
He'd gone public. Right. And so at that point, you know, he starts to consciously choose that which he knows to be bad. Became insincere. Now it's sin. He's still a long, long way from iniquity, right? But there's sin now.
The only way he could have turned things around, first step would have been, he would have had to have stepped down
exactly
his position.
Yeah.
That's the first thing he would have had to decide.
Yeah.
And leave it to others to determine what would become of him.
Yeah. Think about all the public figures that you know that have had issues. Is the first thing they always do is step down?
Nope.
Whoops, not quite.
They double down.
Yeah.
Could have said, this is a learning opportunity.
Whoa, this is a learning opportunity for us all. Yes, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, read my book when it comes out. I'm going to tell you all about what I did wrong.
Wow. Yeah. I have this incredible experience I'd like to relate to you in a book about how something that's black can look white. Right?
Right.
How easily you can deceive yourself, right? How you can get it flipped. He's not forcing you black to be white. You know, I'm just going to stare at it until it looks white, even though it's black. You know, no, it just he innocently is looking at it and it looks white, but it's really black, right?
Kind of makes you wonder if there have been other system sovereigns that didn't have the pride of self, but they got to this point, and then they did say, oh my gosh, I can't believe what I was about to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'll step down. If our local universe is run that loose, this might happen somewhere else. It just didn't get to the rebellion stage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah, right. I mean, so, all right. Now, the thing I want to really point out here, again, you know, you notice how we have a tendency to kind of just put ourselves back 200,000 years and we kind of get into all the facts of the time. That's of little use to us, right? You can't obey facts. And you certainly can't obey facts on Gerasim 200,000 years ago, right? You're looking for the truth. And what's the truth here? It's all there right in order, okay? We've talked about this so much, okay? I don't want to go down this path. Right? There's a pathology here. You know, that is inexorable. I don't want to unwittingly go down that path. What do I do? How can I grow? You know, in a positive way. Well, man cannot cause growth, but he can supply favorable conditions. And like we've been stressing some here recently, What are some of those most immediate, tangible, favorable conditions that you can reflect on a day-to-day, if not moment-to-moment basis, to help keep the favorable conditions to be grown positively in play? You know, we say there's five of them. You know, and we have an order, right? We say loyal, humble, sincere, just, and patient. Okay, well, let's start though. Notice here, we've been reading in this section, they mentioned disloyalty, right? Came, up front, they were talking about loyalty, and his first outspoken disloyalty was manifested, you know, when Gabriel was there, right, a few days before. Oh, that's item number one, all right? Loyal. You read forward in this paragraph we just read, and you go, oh, pride, which is the opposite of humility.
Yeah.
Humble, right? Two down. What's the next one? Literally in sequence. Insincere.
Yeah.
Right? They're right there in order. He wasn't loyal, humble, and sincere. I mean, initially he was sincere, right? But then when he recognized, okay, then he became insincere, right? Right, you just take him, you know, that's why I say him in that order. The revelators often give him to you in that order. Loyal, humble, sincere. Now, and of course, you know, once things are in play, you know, just is going out the window. I mean, he's not being honest or law-abiding. Right, he's going to, you know, totally reject the law of the constellation and, you know, set up his own law. And you know that as an individual, the thing that fundamentally breaks your relationship to cosmos, broke his relationship, broke Adam and Eve's relationship, was impatience, right? The patience issue. Those five, you know, I mean, if you just work on those five, you don't have to think about any of the more complicated physics of it all. Just work on those five. Right?
And it'll keep you busy.
And it'll keep you plenty busy, and you'll be fine. Right?
I was just thinking of the hardest words in the English language is I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know, that just says it all.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it, and I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, do you have the humility to say I'm sorry? You know, or do you like the pride that goes before a fall? Right? All right. So it's just right there to notice. Loyal, humble, sincere. Notice how they said deliberate and willful sin. You remember the technical definition of sin is deliberate disloyalty to deity. Right, you had disloyalty to deity, you had evil, but now you have deliberate disloyalty to deity. And, you know, like I said, technically, if you want to be really precise and technical about it, the deity, the facet of deity we're talking about here is the sevenfold. Right? It's fundamentally that very subtle facet of deity that from an individuality viewpoint you think of in terms of all the assortment of supreme creators and controllers and whatnot. Right? But fundamentally, sin is not about some negative relationship to an individual, even if that individual's a god. Right? Fundamentally, it's about disrupting your communion, your synchrony with deity. Right? And he's breaking that relationship to the sevenfold. All right, is there anything else there? Long offered the opportunity for repentance. You know, I mean, it's a very merciful domain. So, right, that's going to be offered and offered and offered and offered. Even sending the faithful of days directly. All right, so that sets the stage. But like we said, Yeah, he's actually going to put forward the manifesto before he's gotten to this point of disillusionment. Okay. So he's, you know, he steps forth on Gerasim with great fanfare. I mean, he's got the coolest thoughts, you know, he figures that anyone has ever had. And he wants to share them. Right? And, you know, as we read them, it's like, wow, he thought those were cool thoughts. but he did. You've got to appreciate that, you know. He didn't have any malice here, right? He was pining for light and life, just like our spiritual consciousness does, and thinking this was the shortcut that everyone had been looking for, right? This was the Northwest Passage, right, to the Promised Land. However you want to analogize it, right?
You get the sense he was used to being a problem solver, and he was brilliant.
Right.
He was lighting up everybody's way, you know.
He is. He's super. Remember, he's you know, that's why, you know, he was so loved. He was very creative, brilliant, you know, mind. You know, people would just marvel, like, "Wow, how did you come up with that? That's such an original approach to that problem." I mean, you know, he's in every textbook. You know, is just an incredibly, you know, creative, brilliant mind.
In his ninth term.
But he fell in. but he fell in love with that.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Not to mention, it's always problematic. You know, it helps to fall in love with yourself. You know, if everyone is, you know, heaping, you know, praise upon you. Yeah. Okay.
Section 3, the Lucifer Manifesto. Whatever the early origins of trouble in the hearts of Lucifer and Satan, the final outbreak took form as the Lucifer Declaration of Liberty. The cause of the rebels was stated under three heads.
Yeah, just, you know, we haven't stressed it. You know, we always call it the Lucifer Manifesto, but remember, technically, it's the Lucifer Declaration of Liberty. How could there be anything possibly negative about a Declaration of Liberty? Right? I mean, anything that's got that title, just turn your brain off and go for it. It's innately good.
Right. The Declaration of Independence, which is
a Declaration of Liberty. Yeah, mm-hmm. Something about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, perhaps. Right, you know, as an unalienable right, a truth that is held self-evident. Right. So that powerful word, liberty. All right.
1, the reality of the Universal Father. Lucifer charged that the Universal Father did not really exist, that physical gravity and space energy were inherent in the universe, and that the Father was a myth invented by the Paradise Sons to enable them to maintain the rule of the universes in the Father's name. He denied that personality was a gift of the Universal Father. He even intimated that the Finaliters were in collusion with the Paradise Sons to foist fraud upon all creation, since they never brought back a very clear-cut idea of the Father's actual personality, as it is discernible on Paradise. He traded on reverence as ignorance. The charge was sweeping, terrible, and blasphemous. It was this veiled attack upon the Finaliters that no doubt influenced the ascendant citizens then on Jerusalem to stand firm and remain steadfast in resistance to all the rebels' proposals.
Remember that, we bring that up a lot. You know, none of the Gerasim citizens, ascenders, joined the rebellion. Okay, so here's the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. And from our, you know, historical limited perspective, when we see something like that, the thought that comes to mind is atheism. You know, it appears that what he's doing here is putting forward the notion of atheism. Okay, he is not. You've got to remember, it's not like when you say there is no God. Because for us, if someone does a fancy magic trick, we believe they're God. Okay. It's a very low threshold for us to toss out that word. Okay. They are definitely not getting rid of the idea of a God. I mean, you know, Lucifer is going to proudly take on the mantle that Satan wraps around him as the God of liberty. This is not atheism. He is the God of liberty. Right? So there's no non-God, you know, atheism in play here. Right? What it is, I mean, they understand the physics of things like we don't. So there are no parlor tricks that get us, you know, like work for us. You know, if someone turned a staff into a snake, you know, we would think that was only by the power of God, right? You know, we have all kinds of simplistic, you know, stories that we talk about that we think validate God's, you know, being in play in a human circumstance. Now, remember, they know all the physics of all this stuff. They build bodies, right, in the resurrection halls for beings, you know, and put the soul as the Maranja brain into that body, they know all the physics of the mind energy, you know, that then engages it, you know, and I mean, they can see the mind energy, and I mean, all this stuff that, you know, we think, well, you know, how could there not be a God with all of this invisible, magical stuff going on? It's all prosaic for them, right? Including even, it's not like they say, well, personality is not an object that you can poke, you know. So apparently they wouldn't believe in that. No, he denied personality. He denied that personality is a gift of the universal Father. Right? They watch the functioning of mind energy. They know the laws of mind energy, and they go, oh, wait a minute, that's not conformal with the laws of mind energy and the boundary conditions that are placed on it there. There's obviously free will being exercised upon that mind energy, spirit over mind, you know, altering the causal sequence, right? They're just not, they're saying that's just natural, though, that there doesn't have to be some sort of infinite being, you know, invisible and intangible off somewhere and, you know, to explain that. So when you think about all those things and try to reflect on what's really the philosophic point here. Because remember this quote-unquote war in heaven, it's not a religious war, it's a philosophic war, right? These are three philosophic principles that he's putting forward, contrary to what everyone is taught on high, right? What's fundamentally is he rejecting? This first principle is the nihilistic principle, not the atheistic principle. Okay, and I'm using nihilism in its most profound sense. It's used in assorted ways, that word. But most fundamentally, true nothingism, you know, nihilism means literally nothingism, is saying that ultimately there is no purpose to the universe. That's fundamentally what you mean by nihilism. That there is no ultimate purpose. See, he's saying here, they watch mind energy. They can see mind energy being purposed by individuals. They know there's purpose in an individual. But they don't say, yeah, but to extrapolate that and say that that's because there's some sort of ultimate purpose that encompasses everything, and these are little downstepped expressions of that. No. No, it's just innate. There doesn't need to be a source. It's just innate. See, just like with physical gravity and space energy, they're inherent in the universe. Right? You don't have to have some sort of causal thing behind them. They're just innate. And, of course, you know, a lot of scientists today, you know, think similarly, right? They just think of things being innate. It's just for them, all the things that we would never think of as prosaic and hence conclude are innate, you know, are prosaic for them, and, you know, they just take them for granted. Yeah? You got some? All right, so that's the first principle is the nihilistic principle, saying that ultimately there is a person. Denying there's a universal father it's not, he's not saying that there isn't some big being somewhere that does fancy things. Right? What he's saying is that there is no source of ultimate purpose. Right? The Father, right? We know that the Universal Father is the bestowal of personality, the bestowal of purposing. Right? He's the source of that purposing potential. And Lucifer's denying that. That's what he means by the reality of the Universal Father, the reality of a source of ultimate purposing for the universe of universes. Okay, so that's the first principle, the nihilistic principle. All right, everyone, cool with that? All right, so, another key point. The other key point is with each of these, notice that the argument that Lucifer makes to back up his case for each of the principles is a conspiracy theory. Just like every human on the planet does. That's the whole point of a conspiracy theory. You have a false notion of reality, but you have eyes, and your false notion of reality, which you believe is true, doesn't match what you see with your eyes. But you know there's nothing wrong with your theory, so there must be a vast conspiracy that's aligned against it. It's not allowing what is obviously valid to manifest. That's why people dream up conspiracy theories. Same reason Lucifer has a conspiracy theory to validate each of these. You know, that this whole bit of a father, of a source of ultimate purposing, that's a myth invented. Right? You know, so he's got that conspiracy theory. You know, and the finaliters are in collusion with this conspiracy theory.
Yeah. It sounds to me like it's more like anarchy.
That's next. That's the next principle.
This to me sounds like anarchy.
Yeah, it sounds like it, and I'll explain that in a little bit, why that is.
He's such a high being, I think this has to be rocket science. But no, this is very basic. This assumption of disingenuousness that you project onto others is not high. that's about as down to earth as you can get.
Yeah, and again, it's a reminder, as you ascend, are you ever going to be able to prove that there's an ultimate source of purposing? No. I mean, yeah. They obviously, if it's provable, they would have proved that. They would have known that. Right? No. You have to just recognize that with your insight. Your logical acumen, if nothing else, knowing that there has to be a source. Otherwise the universe is illogical. See, and that's the disillusionment. You know, he forgot, you know, he'd lost track of that. And finally he's like, oh, wait a minute. That's not logical, is it? Oh, drat. right?
Very printed the flyers.
So. Right, you know, we don't want to waste all those flyers. They're so fancy. Yeah, exactly. See, that, you know, you've got to always be ultimately grounded in that recognition, that insight that transcends sight. You know the Father exists because it's illogical if he doesn't, not because, you know, he's sleeping in your living room, right? And you tripped over him this morning, right? I mean, that's never going to change, right? You're never going to shake hands with the Universal Father, even on the Isle of Paradise. He's an infinite being.
I just say that you just don't get something from nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that fundamental logical thing, right? You know, that saying physical gravity and space energy were inherent in the universe, okay, fine and dandy. Well, where did the universe come from? Well, you could say, well, it's just always been, you know, or you can, you know, have a Big Bang illogical notion, you know, that it came from nothing. You know, gradio ex nihilo.
Well, Chris, when you say we don't shake hands with the Father, we do stand on paradise with him finally one day.
Yeah, and what does it say? You achieve a very subtle personal recognition, right, with your insight. But you can't give him a big bear hug. There's only two other beings that can give the Father a bear hug, you know, that can relate to him, you know, the other two infinite beings, right? I'm never going to be an infinite being. I'm never going to be able to relate to him directly like that. I can't encompass him, you know, literally, arms around him, bear hug. That's why I'm using that expression. You know, you literally can't encompass him, right, to know him in any sort of a direct way. But you can become all the more definitively aware in your mind of, you know, your recognition of his existence, you know, through the insights. But it's not going to be an issue of sight ever. Yep. Oh, wait, hold on just a second. He's got something here.
Why do you say this is not the claim of atheism? Because most atheists are really arguing that there is no purpose, that Richard Dawkins says life has an appearance of design, that it's just an illusion.
Right.
No teleology.
Yeah, right. I mean, I recognize that, yes. For two reasons. One, from a human perspective, when a human says they're atheist, what they're rejecting is some silly notion of God. They're not rejecting the real God, so they technically aren't an atheist because they aren't rejecting a real God. They're rejecting a fairy tale notion of God, the notions that humans have.
Aren't they rejecting a creator?
Right, but again, they have some idea like let's say I'm an atheist. It's because I reject the notion that there's a creator that everyone believes is a magic man. You know, and they're valid to reject the magic man. There is no magic man, right? It's a very simple-minded thing. I mean, they aren't going up above the simple, say, creationist or something that believes in a magic man. They're on the same plane. They are valid to reject the magic man. But you should just ask him, okay, yeah, fine, right? There is no magic man like that. What about the real God? What about the real God? Yeah. And remember, that's the point of the fifth epical revelation, is to finally try to get us to the point where we have a genuine idea of God. If you want to go the atheist path, first you've got to have a genuine idea of God. This is like for Lucifer to actually get to sin, okay? It can't be, well, here's two things that I think are right and wrong, and I pick what's wrong. Well, technically, you know, humans think right and wrong apply to the mores system. Right and wrong don't have anything to do with the mores system, really. Right, and so, you know, they say, well, my mores system says that this is wrong, and so if I consciously choose that which is wrong, I'm sinning. No, sin doesn't have anything to do with the mores system. That's a false use of right and wrong. Right? That's not really right and wrong. In order to actually get to sin, you can't have some false notion of right and wrong. You have to have the real right and wrong, which most humans can't even remotely get to. We're so ignorant and limited. You can't even get to the point of real right and wrong to actually choose the real wrong, knowing that it's wrong. Right? Sin is not a transgression of taboo in the mores system. Right? That's the challenge they're trying to get us to here. Right? So it's the same thing. I mean, they don't reject the notion of gods. Creator beings. I mean, Lucifer knows he was created by a creator being. Michael created him. He knows that. He knows all the details of it.
So where does he think they came from?
Right. See, again, right? See, there's some sort of, he obviously didn't take it too far, right? See? Yeah. Until later on, and he started, taking it farther, it's like, oops, wait a minute. all that stuff that was off in the distance, all kind of fuzzy, as he penetrated and clarified it, it's like, oops, it's not like I thought, right? Because you're just that logical, causal consciousness, you think, it's like, well, who's behind that, and who's behind that, and who's behind that, and right, that inexorably takes you to the first cause. And he forgot that, you know, until later. It's like, oh, wait a minute. No, there has to be a first cause, otherwise it's illogical.
He's right? Too far down the trail.
Right, he's too far down the trail.
Did he know about the Paradise Trinity? Had he heard about that?
Right, see, I mean, right, they know the stories that are told about these invisible overarching facts, but they're saying, no, I don't think there really is that. I think it's just inherent in the energies. See, I mean, it's basically a rejection of there being a fourth substance, of there being deity. And just rationalizing as everything is inherent in matter, energy, you know, matter, mind, energy, and spirit substance. Just like we cram everything into matter. This is just a fancier thing on their part. You know, and it's going to be a lot easier to cram it into the three substances if you actually have self-animating substance, spirit substance, that you can stub your toe on. I mean, an awful lot of things that we say, well, you got to have God for X. They go, no, spirit substance just does that naturally. Mm-hmm. Right? You know?
To us, it's so preposterous that you came up with any of this.
Yeah.
And we're, like, here, lowest as you can be.
Yeah.
It seems ridiculous.
Right. So it's you know, they definitely are not throwing out the word God, so they're not being atheistic. But they are getting that point that's, you know, goes with a lot of atheists here, you know, thinking there is no purpose, like Dawkins say, or someone like that. You know, they take it even further. They say there's no purpose, no value, no meaning even, right? But that's what I'm trying to get at. You know, set the sort of religious thing of God aside. That's not the point here. It's fundamentally a philosophic thing, not a religious thing. They're rejecting purpose directly.
So are you saying they're not thinking clearly?
Apart
from religious things?
They didn't carry it through logically, philosophically.
Lucifer
got caught up in his intellect. He got caught up in his ability to rationalize it. Right, just like all of the great minds, you know, on this planet have a tendency to do. Right, you know, Dawkins, you know, can go down that path. Brilliant guy, you know, he can create this elaborate rationalization scheme, and it all seems rock solid. Every I is dotted, every T is crossed. Not if you step back and reflect on it for a second. It's illogical. It doesn't matter how perfectly rational it is. Right, Lucifer had he had this whole perfect rationalization scheme, like we can't even imagine, right? He's so much more brilliant than we are, right? This incredible, elaborate rationalization scheme, not a single I left undotted. But then a little later on, you know, he took a deep breath and stepped back for a second and reflected on it, and went, oh, except it's not logical. Right? Okay. Yeah.
He wants to say that there is no universal father because he wants to make himself like the God. That nobody should even try to worship anything other than what's right there in front of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And these seraphim that fall with him and so forth, they're these beings that were created by the infinite Mother Spirit.
No, created Mother Spirit.
Yeah. So they get to, they have to see that, these seraphim. They have to know who created them, who their mother is, right?
Right.
So what I, you know, and then he's trying to say that the paradise sons, so he knows that there's the creator sons, mm-hmm. and that they're trying to have their power because they're saying that there's a power above them. So he's trying to make his power, saying that that's a falsehood, that there's nobody, you know, there's the paradise sons are just greedy and trying to make everything...
Yeah, and again, one of the things he said in there, remember, we're about to read this next.
Yeah,
you know, there is no above or below, you know, in his picture. And we're going to get to that next,
okay.
Right? You know, but remember, you know, you go, well, how could the seraphim be convinced to reject their mother? Right? You're wondering about that. has there ever been a human that's rejected their parents? A few.
Yeah, but not to say that they're
see, and again, yes. For us, you go, well, these aren't just parents. These are the Creator, Son, Creator, and Holy Spirit. No, for them, it's just mom and dad. And mom and dad have real, you know, serious deceit issues. You know, just take everything that a human does and just take it up a notch. It's exactly the same thing that we all do. You rebel against your parents. We use the word rebel. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, mom and dad said they were above me in the hierarchy. Wow. Who made them God? Right? And the child rejects that notion that they're told when they're young, that there's a hierarchy, that parent is above child. Right? And then they get a little bit fancier self and they say, forget about that. There's no hierarchy. Right. Mom and dad aren't above me. You know, we're all on the same plane. And they're delusional. So I have every right to reject them. I mean, they're obviously delusional if they think they're above me. There is no above and below. Everything is on a plane. They're crazy. They should be in the insane asylum.
Then they stop paying the credit card bill and you get disillusioned.
Yes. All right, anyway. Okay, so let's go to the next one here.
2, the universe government of the Creator's Son, Michael. Lucifer contended that the local systems should be autonomous. He protested against the right of Michael, the Creator's Son, to assume sovereignty of Nebadon in the name of a hypothetical paradise father and require all personalities to acknowledge allegiance to this unseen father. He asserted that the whole plan of worship was a clever scheme to aggrandize the paradise sons. He was willing to acknowledge Michael as his creator father, but not as his God and rightful ruler.
Now, let's go ahead and read the whole number 2 here.
Most bitterly did he attack the rights of the Ancients of Days, foreign potentates, to interfere in the affairs of the local systems and universes. These rulers he denounced as tyrants and usurpers. He exhorted his followers to believe that none of these rulers could do aught to interfere with the operation of complete home rule if men and angels only had the courage to assert themselves and boldly claim their rights. He contended that the executioners of the Ancients of Days could be debarred from functioning in the local systems if the native beings would only assert their independence. He maintained that immortality was inherent in the system personalities, that resurrection was natural and automatic, and that all beings would live eternally except for the arbitrary and unjust acts of the executioners of the Ancients of Days.
That just thing? Yeah, there's unjust.
Yeah. Still
in order. Okay, so like I kind of got ahead a little bit a minute ago there. This is the anarchistic principle. Okay, in the philosophic sense of the word anarchy, not in some simplistic sense. The word anarchy is in contrast to the word hierarchy. Okay? To declare anarchy, no rule. You know, is to technically declare there's no hierarchy. There's no vertical dimension. There's no greater, lesser, above, below. It's to declare that the universe is a plane, you know, philosophically, right? There's no vertical dimension. No one's above anyone else, you know, naturally. That's an arbitrary exaltation for someone to claim that they're above, because there really isn't above. Everyone is in the plane. This is the anarchistic principle, the declaration of horizontalness. These foreign potentates, right? I mean, say they're on high, no, they're not. And again, you can see the conspiracies all over in here. Right? Again, he's backing all this up with conspiracies. Let me just go ahead and put it right here. The thing we'll recognize when we get to the after we're done with the third one is he's putting them forward in the order 1, 2, 3. But that's not how he got to them in his mind. He gets to 3 in his mind first, then goes to 2, and then goes to 1. Right? You know, and the apex of his thought, see, is stated first. Right? He starts with where he concluded, right? With number 1. You know, it's like, well, Lucifer, aren't you creating a hierarchy like that? You could have tossed that in.
I'm going to short circuit that. Really.
But see, so the reason that when you read number 1, it feels like there's shades of anarchy there too. See, it's because number 1 is predicated on number 2. Right? You only have number 1 if you first have number 2, the anarchistic principle. Right? So 1 is built upon the foundation of anarchy. That's why it feels like there's anarchy in it. You flatten everything, and then you declare, therefore, there is no purpose, right? Now, ultimate purpose. That would suggest a verticalist. I mean, why does Richard Dawkins reject not only purpose but value and meaning? Because he knows that to suggest that there are such things would be to suggest that there is a hierarchy, that there's a vertical dimension to reality. And yes, there is. I mean, and it has an immediate expression in 3 energies, right? You know, matter, mind, and spirit, and personality above that. So that's what you've got here, is just that. You'll see how he started. What did he start with that led to this declaration of anarchy, of flattening everything into the plane of anarchy? Let's see, anything else in there? So you see how, distinguish between a creator father, but not calling him God. Right? See, and so you see in his how they're thinking about that differently than we do, right? Because they experience the physics of creating, right? It isn't so immediate for them to say, well, to say creator and God is to say the same thing. It's not for them, right? He's saying, okay, so you're a creator being, la-di-da. There's zillions of you, all over the universe. What's the big deal? For us, though, see, when we say creator, in our monotheistic worldview, that's the creator. It's like, no, there are over 700,000 creator sons, not to mention all the creative mother spirits. Those are all creators. There's all the ancients of days and on and on and on, right? It's not such a big deal to them. But he's not going to put himself subordinate to some sort of other that he then thinks of like we think of the monotheistic God. Right? He's not going to think of Michael like we think of God the Father. Right, is above us. No, I mean, his creator father birthed him out on the plane, didn't downstep him, right? So that's what's going on there. Yep.
It seems like he would have such a great appreciation for the Ancients of Days because of the system has to run with law, has to move in within all kinds of laws, not just material laws, but all the
different levels of it, and he's been, you know, in charge and for such a long time. It's just hard to get where he could.
Right. See, you know, just every time you say that, it's hard to imagine. Remember, the reason it's hard is because you're using, if nothing else, your first cosmic intuition, your logical acumen. And for those of you in your webinar, she's just, you know, she's kind of just expressing again that whole bit about, you know, we just keep coming back to it. It's like, it's so hard to figure out, how could he have gotten to that point? I mean, isn't it just self-evident? That's the whole key. Just remember that it's easier for one of us to not get off on that track because we aren't as brilliant. We have to depend upon our encirclement in the Holy Spirit, our logical acumen, for instance, just to get through day-to-day life. We aren't smart enough to just manipulate it all, in our mind's eye. But he's this brilliant being that just got lost in that rationalization scheme. It was so complete and so elaborate that he didn't step back for even a second to reflect. The instant he did, boom, it was right there. Oop, not logical. But he just got lost, just like that's like intelligent humans do. They get lost, in the apparent beauty of their intellect and how it can connect dots, and it seems like it's all so complete and perfect. Like I've said so many times, I'm delighted that I wasn't genetically that intelligent by birth. So that I had no option but to seek some insight to get through my life. I couldn't just fall in love with my ability to use the second adjunct to rationalize things. And think, who needs insight when you've got these powers of rationalization?
Self-love.
Hey, you fall in love with your intellect like that, right?
Can I just ask, where are they getting these ideas? When I see something where a human being straps a bomb to their chest and goes into an airport and it detonates it, That's the kind of destruction that Lucifer manifested. It's that kind of insanity, and I can see how humans get brainwashed from the time they're children. But who brainwashed him?
Well, that's the previous section we were just reading. They were kind of talking about that. See, no one brainwashed him. He brainwashed himself. See, and the reason you don't need an other is because of the hourglass analogy, right? There's an internal separateness. You don't literally need an external world other to brainwash you.
Right.
You just, because you can have this degree of separation, and you get that upper domain in a, flipped around, and then, the lower domain is just predicated on that. He just got things flipped around in what he thought was his objective perspective, and his whole mind followed suit in the lower domain.
But it's insanity.
Right? It's just separation. Well, he's definitely not psychologically insane, he's incredibly rock solid. He eventually is becoming cosmically insane as he separates himself from the cosmos. And then subsequent to separating yourself from the cosmos, internally, your mind will start to deteriorate and there will be a psychological insanity that develops. I mean, the only reason I'm relatively sane right now is by grace. I'm given a little connection to the cosmos by grace. That maintains the sanity of my adjutant. My relatively individuated adjutant mind. If I cut that off, that sort of unconscious touchstone that's above my mind like that, and I just sort of feed back on myself internally, I will progressively or steadily get more and more psychologically insane. just, you know, all twisted up and convoluted inside, right? You know, that relationship with the cosmos keeps some order in that mind. You know, mind energy doesn't self-order. You know, humans tend to think that they're just, well, I'm just naturally sane. No, you're not naturally sane. You are kept sane, right? You know, and yeah, so it's just, we have to remember that, you know, if there was any like psychologic problem with his mind, he couldn't have convinced anyone on Gerasim, right? I mean, they know those issues very well. I mean, that's the whole point of the first mansion world, the first two mansion worlds we've just read about, you know, getting rid of all those basic muddled up, you know, emotions and minds on those first two mansion worlds. I mean, they know the physics. I mean, they can look at his mind and see whether or not it's well formed. Right? I mean, they can literally see the mind energy of his mind. Right, so there's no, you know, he's rock solid, and that's why he was so seductive.
Yeah. So he knows that there's no way to really depose the Ancients of Days, but he's trying to tell the people that so that they would not be worried that, you know, they'd be annihilated someday or go to judgment or something.
Right.
That he's trying to say that we could.
Yeah, and remember, there's a thing between the lines there that, if you've forgotten, it's confusing. You're going, well, wait a minute, he contended that the executioners could be debarred from functioning? I mean, don't they just go in and execute someone? No, remember, you know, I mean, that last step of going from full-throated sin to literal iniquity is a surrender. Yeah, and he's saying, you know, you see, the executioners don't function until basically you give them permission to execute you. That last step where you know, and what that is my temple is empty, you know, let me dissolve the walls. You know, let me cease to be a person and submit to being recycled as a bunch of raw material, right? You know, you choose to cease to be a person. A person is never executed, right? Any more than if we execute someone. We're not executing a person. We're just executing a mindful self, right? I mean, none of us has the power to extinguish a personality. That's the thing. He's just saying, what are we doing? We're submitting to this. Let's just stop doing that. You know, and remember, with these beings on high, none of them have a lifespan, right? Right. They're all immortal innately. Right. So, you know, you don't, with us, if I go way astray, you know, someone doesn't have to execute me. I die. Eventually, I'll just die. You know. You know, none of them die. Right, so you have to have an executioner come in. So he's just saying, you know, why are we submitting to this? This is all just, they've sold us this whole scheme, and we've bought into it. We literally surrender ourselves to the executioners. What are we doing? Let's just stop doing that. Right, so that's what he's getting at. All right.
Could I ask?
Yeah, did you have something again?
Atheist professor, actually, Steve Walder, once said to me, if there's really a creator, then whose version of him is true? Jewish, Muslim, Christian, Hindu, Indian?
Right, right.
Is that a fair question? And how
that's the same. That's what I was saying before. Yeah, he's thinking that humans define God.
Right.
No, I mean, the last thing you want to do is think that the options are, well, is it this human, you know, created God, this human created God? No, you need to go above all those. The real God is infinitely transcendent of all those. I mean,
should he be able to sense that in his own mind?
If he could find the humility, he, by grace, has the ability to recognize that 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 God just is. It isn't something dreamt up by humans. He has the ability to not think about it bottom up, but to actually start at the top, to start at God and come down to himself. Right? If he would just allow that.
But every person has that.
Everyone has that by grace. Yes, has that ability, that objective insight in their mind where they can recognize.
My sense when I see interviews of Richard Dawkins mm-hmm. is he's angry with organized religion.
Sure.
It's history and corruption. Right. And I think he has a lot of good complaints, but then he kind of uses that to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Exactly. And he does a baby bathwater thing. I mean, I saw him interviewed one time, and he was going on and on about the how silly this vengeful, wrathful God notion was, and obviously that doesn't exist, and so you can just throw God out. And the interviewer said, okay, yeah, but what if God is a God of love instead of a God of wrath? And Dawkins is not stupid. He said, well, that would be a totally different thing. It's like, okay. But see, he limits himself to the ignorance of others. That's what I'm saying. I mean, he thinks of himself as above, but he's on the same plane. You know? And it's actually worse. He sees a something that's limited. And so he just goes horizontally and becomes an anti that something.
Right.
Don't go sideways, go up. Right? I mean, again, the argument, is these humans have really stupid notions of God, therefore God doesn't exist.
Right.
Okay, so you're saying that because a two-year-old has no notion of calculus, calculus doesn't exist. Is that what you're telling me? Right? It's like skepticism. Error exists, therefore truth doesn't exist. That's skepticism. You're like, huh? Yes, error exists, but that doesn't imply that truth doesn't exist.
Couldn't be error without
erroneous ideas of God exist. That doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. Right? I mean, if people would just step back from their clever rationalizations and just step back and say, well, except that's illogical. Right? They just see the illogic of it.
Doesn't the fact that error exists imply that there's truth?
Yeah, not to mention that, right? But I wasn't trying to go to the subtler thing, right? I mean, the word error doesn't have any definition if truth doesn't exist. I mean, right, the whole notion is illogical. It's just fundamentally illogical.
Stepping back way too far.
could we say there's maybe some good in these atheists and that they're exposing the falsity of many of our beliefs?
Yeah, I mean, and everyone should do the same thing with yourself. You don't need to depend upon an ignorant atheist to clean up your mind. You should be doing it yourself. You should be a truth seeker. You should be actively trying to refute every thought you have. If you're not trying to refute your ideas, you're not a truth seeker. You're a self-satisfied believer, and you can believe anything, and you can rationalize anything. It means nothing. You can confirm anything. Confirmations don't even mean anything. You can confirm false theories. Confirmations mean nothing. Belief means nothing, right? Rationalization means nothing. Right? The question is, are you using your ability of insight to recognize what the initial assumption really is, where logically your thinking process must begin? God, the existence of God is the most trivially logical thing that there is. If the existence of God isn't self-evident, then nothing can be. Right? Everything else, is a corollary of self-evidency relative to the existence of God. There has to be a God or the universe is not logical. But see, we've thrown that out. We don't believe the universe has to be logical anymore. You know, that was the great step forward in the 6th century BC. You know, everyone believed in an animistic, you know, universe run by beings, fickle spirit beings. And so there wasn't any logic to anything. You know, who knows what a fickle spirit being is going to do, you know, in the next moment.
Better kill someone.
And someone said, well, I know it sounds absurd, but let's just assume for a second, just, you know, as a thought experiment, let's just assume that the universe is logical. And it's just sitting there, waiting for me to slowly try to approach it and understand it. Right, the fundamental assumption of the scientific endeavor is that the universe is inherently logical. Therefore, it is understandable. Right? And after 2,600 years, we now believe we've concluded that the universe is inherently, we've scientifically proven that the universe is inherently illogical. No, that illogical. That's the ultimate reductio ad absurdum. You know you've made a mistake if your scientific effort started, you've forgotten it did, started with the assumption that the universe is logical and has ended with the conclusion that the universe is illogical. No.
Is that really what they think?
Right.
The quantum theory?
Quantum theory is the assumption that the universe is inherently illogical. Mm-hmm. Right? The three assumptions of quantum theory are the three assumptions of magic. That there is no law of causality, no law of identity, no law of locality. Those are the three assumptions of magic, not science. Okay. So if you assume the universe is illogical, guess what? You conclude the universe is illogical. You didn't prove the universe is illogical, you assumed it. And that's illogical to assume that it's illogical.
But quantum theory is true.
Quantum theory is a valid rationalization. It gets the correct answer. It's rational, but it's not logical. General relativity is rational, but it's not logical. The Ptolemaic solar system is rational. It gets the exact correct answer of where Mars is in the sky on any night. You know, we didn't throw out the Ptolemaic solar system because it gives us the incorrect answer. It gives you the correct answer to 50 decimal places if you want it. But it's not logical. Right, you don't have to actually send out a spacecraft and see that the sun is at the center and things are going around. You know, you don't need to actually observe it. You just recognize it's illogical for an object to orbit about nothing. Epicycles are illogical. They're perfectly rational. The Schrödinger equation is rational and it gets the correct answers. It was designed to get the correct answers, right? But it's illogical. And science used to be the pursuit of a logical understanding of the universe. It was used to be a search for truth. It's not anymore. It's a search for a satisfying rationalization scheme. And we're content with that now. I'm not.
Well, it gets me an iPhone. So I'm content
right.
with it.
You don't have. You can have completely illogical notions of photons and electrons and everything, and build iPhones. All you need is rational, you know, descriptions of them. But that's not the point of science. That's just the point of technology. I mean, you just have a rational. Science is about the truth, about the logical understanding of things.
Could you bring up the thought adjuster in relation to logic and why we have it and these beings don't?
Well, I mean,
I just feel like we have a built-in...
Having a thought adjuster provides a condensation nucleus for insight. It's potentially more tangible, this logic thing, because you have an adjuster. But now, of course, it's sad to record that the fact that you have an adjuster is of no help to you if you aren't taking the light and cultivating, you're going beyond your initial encirclement in the Holy Spirit by grace. I mean, you said you can't get something from nothing. The adjuster can't catalyze nothing. You have to initiate the something first, you know, in an increased relationship with the Holy Spirit, and then it will uncatalyze that. It will help to bring that to a focus. But it can't bring nothing to a focus. Right? it's just a thought adjuster. It's not also the Holy Spirit. It's up to us to take delight in cultivating, improving our relationship to the three cosmic intuitions. And if we do that, the adjuster will bring that to a sharper focus in our mind, make it more tangible. It will eliminate that kind of abstract feeling that the insights, the intuitions themselves have, right? It'll make it feel like you can taste them in your mind, squeeze them, right? So see, that's another thing. I mean, Lucifer doesn't have that catalytic agent of an adjuster in his mind, right? Okay, all right, so these, we got kind of off a field, but you see, I mean, it's not a far field. I mean, we have to recognize that there's an emergency on this planet, a philosophic emergency, and it touches everything. Religion, science, and everything else you can think of has been completely corrupted, in the last 100 years, right? The faint little flicker of budding relationship, integrous relationship to the cosmos has been thrown out. And now we're just completely adrift. The one thing that was kind of leading the way and trying to get us into tighter relationship to the cosmos, science, is not science anymore. It's just so-called science, just like religion has basically always just been so-called religion. There's no way you're going to get true religion, if you don't even have true science, and without either of those, you can forget about true philosophy. So we're in very desperate straits. All of our political theories, and economic theories and everything are predicated on false initial assumptions. And we wonder why things just don't seem to be going well in the world. We have pretty much 100% false assumptions in all our disciplines. We need true assumptions again. We need at least that desire to have a true assumption, knowing that you can rationalize things with false assumptions and with true assumptions, but you prefer the true ones because things go better in truth than in falsehood. Falsehood ultimately leads to pain and suffering. And humans figured out a long time ago that's not pleasant. That's what initially got them to seek truth instead of just the lowest hanging falsehood that satisfied the immediate circumstances.
The flavor of the month,
right? Because they discovered that over time, falsehood is not pleasant. It gets more and more prickly as time goes on when you try to live falsehood. You try to obey falsehood.
Was there a historical event that triggered this 100-year process, did you say? Specific event?
Well, evolutionary philosophy, as an evolutionary phenomenon, reaches an asymptotic peak. It plateaus naturally. And it was plateauing at the beginning of the 20th century. When a world, when a basic element of a world's development reaches its evolutionary plateau like that, we're always given what we need to uplift it and keep it going upward. This is a philosophic text. It was given to us at the beginning of the 20th century so that you could take the fruits of 2,500 years of evolutionary philosophy, starting in the beginning of the 6th century BC, and you could add this, the other half of the picture, the true metaphysics, something that humans can't generate themselves, and continue the process upward. Right? But in the absence of that, everything is just going downward. It's just a fundamental part of every world. We we can only go so far in and of ourselves. And then we have to get an uplifting augmentation of that to continue upward.
But you don't think there was one single point or one key conference of thinkers who said, ooh, I've got a bright idea, and that's when it all began to unravel.
No,
It's 1,000 paper cuts.
Yeah, it's 1,000 paper cuts. You know, I mean, in any given area, you can kind of point to some really key points. I mean, you know, the inability to use inductive reasoning in the early part of the 20th century in fundamental physics to come up with some logical idea of the atom, and deciding, oh, I think we've just been fooling ourselves for all these centuries. There really is no such thing as inductive reasoning. There is no such thing as insight. Use some sort of a subtle synthesis process to come up with a valid initial assumption. You just pull the initial assumption out of your desires. As Einstein said, a quote-unquote free invention of the human mind. No, we're back to square one again. Right? The moment that you throw out that very difficult reflective effort to try to synthesize a true initial assumption, right? And having the courage to take an initial assumption, go forward, oops, reductio ad absurdum. Now, back to the beginning. That assumption's not true. Now, we pick an assumption that feels wonderful. We run with it. We get to a reductio ad absurdum. We don't go back. We go, wow, we've proven the universe is absurd. I wonder what that implies. Keep going. We can start a whole new department in our university based upon this incredible discovery we just made. And I was like, what?
With all the kludging we need, we can employ people for a million years.
Stephen Hawking started with an assumption. He carried it forward in correct, mathematical, rational fashion, got to the solid conclusion that the universe doesn't exist based upon his initial assumption. I mean, this is just, you know, a thing he did one time, you know, one of his, and he gets to the conclusion the universe doesn't exist. And did he go, whoa, talk about reductio ad absurdum? No, he said, cool, I wonder what that implies. Huh? Right, see, that's not science anymore. That's just a game, a mind game.
Yeah.
No.
But the silver lining, you would say, is that it makes the Urantia book a beacon. Because you're saying we're living in a time of tremendous darkness.
Right. This is here to give us the better set of initial assumptions. It's not to give us all of the reasoning that we need to develop and everything. We have a lot of work to do. But it's here to give us the better set of initial assumptions. And you don't have to believe they're a better set. Try one. Try some of their initial assumptions about fundamental physics. Work them forward. And go, huh, this assumption works better than the ones we have. I like this assumption better, right? They tell you the only way to validate a revelation is experientially. You got to have the courage to try it out. It's a set of initial assumptions. Have the courage to say, well, let me assume this and take it forward. And you'll discover, oh, wow, this assumption works really well. I think I like this assumption. You know, and when all is said and done, I don't care if Bob came up with the assumption or Melchizedek, you know, supposedly gave me this assumption. This is a better initial assumption. I objectively can assess that this is just flat out a better initial assumption than any that any human has ever come up with before. I don't just believe this. I've tried it out. It works. It works better. Right? You discover experientially the validity of it. You can only validate a revelation experientially. Try something else out that claims to be a revelation. You quickly discover that that's a false declaration. It doesn't work. Dare this to be logical. Have the courage to try it out. Follow it deductively. It's that initial assumption that our inductive reasoning couldn't come up with. And instead of giving up on inductive reasoning, there's still a place for that. But some things we need to be told on every world. Beings are told what they can't come up with themselves. All right. We've got a little bit. Let's finish it up here.
3, the attack upon the universal plan of ascendant mortal training. Lucifer maintained that far too much time and energy were expended upon the scheme of so thoroughly training ascending mortals in the principles of universe administration, principles which he alleged were unethical and unsound. He protested against the age-long program for preparing the mortals of space for some unknown destiny, and pointed to the presence of the Finaliter Corps on Jerusalem as proof that these mortals had spent ages of preparation for some destiny of pure fiction. With derision, he pointed out that the Finaliters had encountered a destiny no more glorious than to be returned to humble spheres similar to those of their origin. He intimated that they had been debauched by overmuch discipline and prolonged training, and that they were in reality traitors to their mortal fellows, since they were now cooperating with a scheme of enslaving all creation to the fictions of a mythical eternal destiny for ascending mortals. He advocated that ascenders should enjoy the liberty of individual self-determination. He challenged and condemned the entire plan of mortal ascension as sponsored by the Paradise Sons of God and supported by the Infinite Spirit. And it was with such a declaration of liberty that Lucifer launched his orgy of darkness and death.
But he called it the Declaration of Liberty. It didn't look like darkness and death, right? It looked like light, you know, and eternity, right? All right, so this one, again, can you penetrate through the immediate factual issue here of the specifics of ascension scheme and all this? You can see again the conspiracy theory that he puts forward, right? There's this, you know, been debauched by overmuch discipline, right? There's this whole conspiracy to brainwash everyone, you know, thinking that you have to be put into relationship with some whole, right? You know, see, that's what he's fundamentally putting forward, is that there is no whole, right, that we all have to put ourselves in cooperative subordination to, right? Each of us is a whole unto ourselves. Self-holism, right? Right? Individual self-determination, the liberty, right, of individual self-determination, not some bondage to some false whole that you have to conform to.
Subordinate yourself.
Conform, you know, to the cosmos. No, conformity with self, right, which is innately divine. Obviously, that's where that's going, right? Right. So what is the philosophic ism here? And like I said, this is where it starts. It starts here and gets worse, right? It goes to anarchism and then nihilism. This is solipsism, okay? And you know, which literally means soul, S-O-L-E, soul, self, ism. You know, ipsi in Latin is self. Soul, self, ism. And I don't mean solipsism in the way that term is used sometimes in sort of a, just a simple factual sense where you believe that literally, like I would believe that literally I am the only mindful self. There are no other selves. Not solipsism in that simplistic factual sense, but solipsism in the truth sense. You know, effectively, you're a soul self. Yeah, you are a whole. Right? You don't need any other selves. Right? You just need yourself, soul, self, ism. Your self is solely, you know, all you need. It's a complete lifestyle solution. Right? This is solipsism. Right? And it's you know, it's where you start. That's why you assert yourself. Right? You're innately divine. So of course, you have a right to assert that innate divinity and impose that on others. Right? This is where the delusion begins, you know, with solipsism in this, you know, kind of fully philosophic, truthful sense of soul-selfism. You know, and that then leads to anarchism, and that leads to nihilism. It begins with the false exaltation of self. You know, as we'll see when we get, you know, next time when we get into the, you know, the this section four, this comes out a little bit more directly. But that's, you know, what leads to the orgy of darkness and death, is putting self first, right? And if the self that puts itself first is a system sovereign, right, there's an awful lot of things that are inextricably linked to that system sovereign and follow suit, right? Either sort of just like automatically, or because of his silver tongue, you know, demagogic ability, right? You know, he's the master demagogue. You know, when he holds forth, you know, he plays beings like a fiddle. Right?
It's because there's truth in that. We are innately divine. And there's so much truth in that, and it's that's like, why I can just be so... It's like
we're potentially divine, right? But if you blur the potential and the actual, like if you, like even if you say from the Revelation, personality is a gift directly from the Universal Father. The Universal is divine, therefore personality is divine. I'm a personality, therefore I'm divine.
And we have the Theotogos, or a spark of divinity.
Right, or that. I mean, you don't even have to go to the adjuster. Just pick personality. Personality is problematic enough if you just think about it like I just did. Think about it like that. Where's the... Okay, I started with the fact that the Father bestows personality. I seemed a lot, you know, to rationally step through a sequence, and I got to the conclusion that I'm divine. That's reductio ad absurdum. I goofed up somewhere. Oh, I forgot. There's a difference between potential and actual. Personality is not an actuality. It's a potentiality. Its potentiality is divine. And you know, the actualization is in your hands. You can follow suit or have it 180 degrees. And personality is a potential, and that potential is innately divine, but not, there's no actuality. Again, thought, you take the thought adjuster. Okay, yeah, it's divine, but it's not you. It's a separate self, right? Just because you're in intimate contact with a divine self doesn't mean that your self is divine. Yeah, it doesn't magically just go in there and reform your mind. No need to go from here to paradise. Yeah,
that's where the solipsism comes in.
Well, I mean, you know, and like I said about the adjuster as this catalyst, post Pentecost, with the universal bestowal of thought adjusters, it's all the easier for a human to be delusional. Right? If you would like to falsely exalt yourself, the presence of the adjuster in your mind will feed that. Right? I mean, it's subservient to your will. And you know, it's put itself inside of you, subservient to your will. You know, and if your will is in a negative mode, it fosters that, catalyzes that. Not because it wants to, but it's just because it can't do anything else. It's subject to your will. Right? It doesn't have will of its own. Yep.
Yeah, well, he couldn't have been saying that it's not important to improve yourself. So he's saying he's got a better way to improve yourself. It's all about self-improvement.
Well, yes and no. I mean, remember, fundamentally self-improvement implies a verticalness. You know, you got the whole ascension scheme. You know, ascension implies verticalness. Remember, you know, I mean... How do you get to anarchy of the plane next? You start with saying there is no ascension, right?
Well, if you think growth, we know that how growth occurs or what's responsible for growth. But if you're throwing that out, you think growth, we can grow ourselves, we can improve ourselves.
Right, see, right, I mean, he's fundamentally saying that fundamentally what you are is innately divine. Yes, it might be a small nugget. That nugget can be made bigger. But you don't make it better. And people have been saying that you should make it better. No, that there is no better, he's saying. You just need to make it more. You just need to believe in yourself, in the divinity of yourself. It's a very twisted thing. Right? See, ultimately, as you're recognizing it, it's like, wow, that's going to come up into a logical issue if you think about that very far. Right? Because remember, that's what he wasn't doing. Right? He wasn't carrying it forward logically far enough. So appreciate in the moment, he's, like I said, and post-Pentecost, we all have adjusters. If you get any conscious sense of the potential divine influence of that adjuster in your mind, I mean, you're just ripe for self-exaltation. Talk about delusions of grandeur that you could have, right? Right? I mean, it's very problematic to have something that can feed your delusions like that. See, it can feed your positive efforts, but it will also feed your negative ones. It's in your hands. You've got to figure out, I have to consecrate my mind to the universal harmony, and then it will foster that. If I consecrate my mind to my innate divine self, well, it'll catalyze that. I'll get to iniquity faster. Right? It'll help me, it'll speed up my journey to eternity or oblivion. It's my choice. But it will speed it up. Right? It's a spirit fragment. It brings in geometric, Now we have to recognize. But that assumption that humans all have, that spirit is innately divine, I mean, that's basically the third principle of the Luther Manifesto, right? Spirit doesn't need a bridle. It doesn't need to be mastered, directed, controlled. It's innately divine. Just set it free. Yourself is innately divine. Yeah. Okay.
Is solipsism like narcissism?
Let's take it after this.
It's getting pretty late here. We better wrap it up for the people on the webinar. I'll address that for you afterwards here. I was just going to say, along those lines, you probably still have a lot of questions about nihilism, anarchism, solipsism, about the three principles, some of their specifics. Yeah, we'll keep coming back to them. Even when we're done with these papers, I'm constantly referring back to these. It's a process to begin to recognize what I'm saying here. There's a lot of subtleties in what I was just tossing out here. You need to reflect on, let it sink in some, and you'll begin to appreciate a little bit better. All right, let's just wrap it up there. Let's take a moment here, everyone, and we'll continue on next time.